Emily Dickinson and I did not hit it off on the first date. That is to say, on introduction to her work, I saw her, or rather was taught to see her, as a ladylike poet writing of hearts and flowers, tendrils and vines, the stuff of which had absolutely nothing to do with my life.
I never thought, actually, that I would be known as this kind of gay Hollywood historian, which I'm thrilled about, but it wasn't something that was planned. It just kind of happened.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Tasmania acclaims its top range of legally recognized relationships, a carefully opened love affair with Emily, and behind the screen with the man who takes you to where the boys are. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 30th, 2003. Tasmania today leads the world in the recognition of people in same-sex and other significant relationships. The Australian state's government proclaimed this week after its relationships bills narrowly won approval from the state's upper house. Political compromises that weakened some parenting rights may make that a bit of an overstatement, but the sweeping reforms do offer the option to gain legal status equivalent to marriage in well over 100 state laws for what's believed to be the world's widest range of personal relationships, including non-sexual ones. They also create Australia's first state-level partnership registry, which will likely open in January.
Five of Australia's seven other states and territories have extended legal recognition in a variety of areas to gay and lesbian couples who've lived together for some time, and similar reforms are under consideration in the other two. But Tasmania will be the first to offer those couples a means to establish a legal relationship without cohabiting first.
However, Australian national law still discriminates against same-gender couples in many key areas, including social security, pensions, and taxation, and the ruling coalition has consistently opposed reform bills. In fact, a recent rewrite of the Australian Defence Force's Entitlements Manual actually made more explicit that gay and lesbian service members' partners are excluded from benefits, defying a finding by the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission.
Tasmania's relationships bills were the subject of heavy lobbying from both sides, with religious conservatives particularly targeting the prospect of equal parental rights for non-traditional couples. The state's Australian Labor Party government dropped its effort to win full equal adoption rights for registered partners even before the relationships bills were passed by the state parliament in mid-July. The new laws will allow one partner to co-adopt the other's biological children. But to pass the bills in the upper house, the ALP needed the support of several independents, and they made their support contingent on deleting automatic parental status for the partners of lesbians impregnated by artificial insemination. However, those partners can go through the co-adoption process, and a parliamentary inquiry will continue to review the issue.
Tasmania's leading gay activist, Rodney Croom, attributed the hard-won victory in the upper house to the personal lobbying efforts of gay and lesbian parents and their children, saying they put themselves on the line and told their personal stories, and that was crucial in getting the legislation through. This is a good example of where the quietest voices have spoken the loudest.
Colombia's National Senate this week rejected a bill to extend both legal recognition to same-gender couples and civil rights protections to lesbians, gays, and transgenders. Couples would have gained equal status in areas including healthcare decisions, employment benefits, insurance, pensions, social security, inheritance, and support payments on dissolution. There had been high hopes for the bill's passage, particularly given its endorsement by three of Colombia's former presidents, Alfonso López Michelsen, Julio César Turbe, and César Gaviria Trujillo. Gaviria, now Secretary General of the Organization of American States, said last week, "If we want it to be true, as our Constitution promises, that Colombians are free and equal before the law, then it is necessary to guarantee equal rights for unions between homosexuals." But after lengthy debate, more than 60% of the senators voted against the bill. One leading opponent said it would put an unpayable burden on the Social Security system. But Britain's Gay and Lesbian Humanist Society fears the vote in largely Roman Catholic Colombia reflects the Vatican's recent publication demanding that politicians of their faith work actively to block any legal recognition of same-gender couples. Supporters say they'll reintroduce the measure next year.
California's state Senate this week passed a bill to further expand the rights and responsibilities of the statewide domestic partners registry. If enacted, it will make the California registry second in the U.S. only to Vermont's civil unions in legal power. It would extend perhaps 90% of the state-level benefits of marriage, according to its sponsor, openly lesbian Democratic Assemblymember Jackie Goldberg of Los Angeles. The other 10% of benefits would require a two-thirds vote of the legislature. The current measure passed the Senate on a party-line vote with only a couple of votes more than the required minimum. The California Assembly had already passed the bill in June by the bare minimum required, but must now consider the Senate's amendments, which include dropping the right to file state income taxes jointly.
Embattled Democratic Governor Gray Davis had announced last week that he'd sign the bill, a message he repeated following the Senate vote. The question is whether he'll be in a position to do so, with a recall vote looming on October 7th. The leading Democrat in the huge field hoping to replace Davis is Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante, who's also endorsed the bill. The leading Republican is film star Arnold Schwarzenegger, who hasn't yet formally stated a position on this bill, but said in an interview this week that while he believes marriage should be between a man and a woman, he supports domestic partnerships.
Davis signed the original California partnerships law after his Republican predecessors had repeatedly blocked similar moves. He later signed its expansion to carry its current benefits, which include hospital visitation, medical decision-making, co-adoption, inheritance, and standing to sue for a partner's wrongful death. The current measure would add spousal rights over a partner's funeral arrangements, the ability to withhold legal testimony against a partner, property rights, health insurance and pension benefits, joint consideration in qualifying for state assistance payments, responsibility for a partner's debts to third parties, and the option for divorce proceedings in court with rights to community property, support payments, and child support.
Another bill currently pending Governor Davis' action after passage by the California Assembly last week is intended to improve the situation of lesbian, gay, and transgender children in foster care. It would prohibit discrimination or harassment in foster care based on sexual orientation or gender identity, train foster parents to meet that requirement, and bar them from pressuring children to change their orientation.
One of Davis's aides is taking the heat for a military memorial formally unveiled this week. The foot-long paving stone at the California Veterans Memorial near the state capitol reads, "In honor of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender veterans killed in action." The activists and dignitaries at the ceremony called it long overdue. Though the marker was paid for with private funds, it was billed as the first state-sanctioned landmark honoring the memory of those service members. But some non-gay veterans objected to it as inappropriate, political, or insulting, and it emerged that some procedural steps in actually obtaining state sanctions had been skipped. The governor's office has promised to sort things out.
The annual EuroPride Festival was held this week in Manchester, England, site of the original Queer as Folk. Over 300,000 people participated in the 11-day festival. It took 200 people to carry the half-ton, quarter-mile-long rainbow flag that led the climactic parade through the gay village to the tooting of thousands of pink whistles. One of the more than 60 groups marching were some of Manchester's own police officers in uniform. With jugglers, stilt walkers, and fire eaters, as well as an array of impersonators, openly gay actor Ian McKellen declared, "The most stylish theater in the UK is here on the streets of Manchester." After the parade, McKellen bemoaned Hollywood closets, saying the hidden gay and lesbian film stars cannot be happy with themselves and are sending a dreadful message to their fans.
And finally, there was no hiding the kisses at this week's MTV Video Music Awards, where superstars Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera opened the show with an homage to Madonna's performance of Like a Virgin at the same ceremony 20 years before. Not only were millions watching the live TV coverage as Madonna herself and Spears shared an open-mouthed smooch, but it was replayed ad infinitum and recounted in other media all over the world. Aguilera also got a smooch from Madonna, but somehow, amazingly, the live cameras were elsewhere. It's worth mentioning that Aguilera received an award this year from GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, for the empowering portrayals of a gay male couple and a transgender in her video, Beautiful, that Spears has gay male girlfriends, prefers the music at gay clubs, and is grateful for her gay male audience, and that, way back when, the always gay support of Madonna was herself involved with Sandra Bernhardt.
Being the MTV Video Music Awards, you wouldn't expect quite so much shock at women kissing, despite a certain breathlessness in the debate as to whether or not tongues were involved, yet it seemed to overshadow the bestowing of the awards themselves. Many pundits took the occasion to recount the history of kisses between women on U.S. television. Many worked the thesaurus to the bone to come up with synonyms for osculation. Most took the occasion to jab both at so-called lesbo chic and at Madonna, presuming she was acting primarily to connect with the youth audience and promote her latest album. Not that there's anything wrong with that. One of the more gracious versions was the New York Times. It was an impressive spectacle, but it was hard not to be reminded that 19 years ago, Madonna could cause this much fuss all by herself.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 30th, 2003, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm John Beaupre.
He went behind the screen to find the Biograph girl and a wisecracker, and now the writer who separated the men from the boys talks about where the boys are later in the program. In different ways and in different decades since the beginning of the second wave of feminism, lesbians of note have been slipping out of their historical closets. Commentator Janet Mason reflects on her introduction to and rediscovery of one of the best known and best loved of them.
Imagine my surprise. I love that I found you, but I ache all over wanting to know your every dream. Imagine my surprise to find that I love you, feeling warm all over knowing that you've been alive. Poet of great acclaim, I have been misreading you. I never knew your poems were meant for me. You lived alone in a quiet den, pouring passion through your pen and weeping for your lady lovers as they safely married men.
Emily Dickinson and I did not hit it off on the first date. That is to say, on introduction to her work, I saw her, or rather was taught to see her, as a ladylike poet writing of hearts and flowers, tendrils and vines, the stuff of which had absolutely nothing to do with my life. In junior high, when I came across Dickinson's work, I was already a hell-on-wheels, hard-drinking adolescent, a product of my 1970s working-class environment that put me on a collision course headed toward disaster. It was my love of language that got me through. I've often heard it said that poetry serves no purpose. Perhaps that is true if one takes a completely materialistic and emotionally bankrupt view of life. But the fact is that two lines of poetry saved my life. Shakespeare's "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow" creeps through this petty pace from day to day. I didn't know it at the time, but that I could recite this part of Hamlet at will, even if I was on my way to being blasted or hungover from the night before, embedded in my mind that I would have a tomorrow. A tomorrow was not a petty thing to have. A few of my friends didn't make it. In midlife, I find myself reflecting on the past. I wonder if things could have been different for myself and for the close-knit gang of teenage girls I hung out with. I wonder if a lesbian reading of Emily Dickinson could have halted our self-destruction and consequently saved a few young lives. It took a few more years for me to grow up, stop drinking, and come out as a lesbian, and when I did, I found myself falling head over heels in love with poetry. Emily Dickinson was someone I returned to again and again. There was something clever yet profound in her verses that I memorized. The lines were deeply personal, as if they had been written just for me. I found her public persona intriguing. She was portrayed as a spinster, a recluse dressed in white, the eternal virgin who had nothing to do with men. A few more years passed, and I went back to visit the Dickinson homestead in Amherst, Massachusetts. I was there with a group of friends, some of whom lived in the area and were just visiting her home for the first time. It was ironic, really. There we were, a room full of lesbian poets, listening to the tour guide's official rap about the cloister and asexual Emily Dickinson trapped in her father's house. There was something sinister about the house, foreboding. But behind the house, in the flower garden, was a beautiful wash of colors. And as I sat in the garden on a white wrought iron bench, I peered through a shady grove to the neighboring house. I remember it being painted in the glowing hues of peach, at once golden and pink. There was something mysterious about this house, set back as it was from the road, directly approachable from the Dickinson homestead. If I were Emily, I could not have resisted its magic lure. I found out later that this house is where Susan Huntington Dickinson lived. She was Emily's sister-in-law, married to Emily's brother, Austin, and she was the love of Emily Dickinson's life. She was muse to Emily, her intended reader, thoughtful critic, and, by more than a few accounts, she was Emily's lover. In correspondence to Susan, Emily wrote that Susan was imagination itself. These two women were close friends for 40 years, and they lived next door to each other for 30 of those years. In Open Me Carefully, Emily Dickinson's intimate letters to Susan Huntington Dickinson from Paris Press, the editors point out that over the course of their lifelong friendship and love affair, Emily sent countless numbers of letters, poems, and a form of writing that Emily came to call the letter poem. And on many of these letters, placed for Susan to see when she unfolded them, Emily had written her careful instructions, "Open me carefully." Emily Dickinson lived in puritanical New England from 1830 to 1886. After her death, any mention of Susan was carefully removed from her poetry, and this essential body of correspondence was neglected. Still, even with the erasure of Susan's name, which Emily had written at the top of so many of her poems, it is obvious that they are essentially lesbian love poems. Consider, for example, the piece that begins with the line, "Her breast is fit for pearls." Susan. Her breast is fit for pearls, but I was not a diver. Her brow is fit for thrones, but I have not a crest. Her heart is fit for home. I, a sparrow, build there, sweet of twigs and twine, my perennial nest. Emily. In Victorian New England, Emily Dickinson certainly could not mention her most intimate body parts, but she did a pretty good job of using the birds and bees as metaphor. These days of heaven bring you nearer and nearer, and every bird that sings and every bud that blooms does but remind me more of that garden unseen, awaiting the hand that tills it. Dear Susie, when you come, how many boundless blossoms among the silent beds. To separate Emily Dickinson from her lesbian passions is a cruel and unnecessary act. Not only does it do a disservice to Emily's poetic genius, but it also deprives her readers of a deeper comprehension of Emily and therefore of a deeper understanding of themselves. That's what literature at its best does. It leads us home. It really doesn't matter if Emily Dickinson ever made love with a woman, although my guess is that she did and most likely did so rather skillfully. What matters is that she experienced deep, rending passion that must at times, under the circumstances, have been painful. A lesbian reading of Emily Dickinson places her firmly in the center of her own page. When I think back on my visit to her house, I can see her clearly now, sitting down at her desk after her daily chores were done, as she smooths the white folds of her skirt and picks up her quilled pen. As she writes, her cheeks are ablaze with longing and desire, that essential lesbian desire. With commentary on Open Me Carefully, Emily Dickinson's intimate letters to Susan Huntington Dickinson from Paris Press, and thanks to Deborah D'Alessandra for production assistance, this is Janet Mason for This Way Out.
Imagine my surprise. Thank you.
Hola amigos, this is Luis Alfaro, performance artist, playwright.
This is Monica Palacios, Aztec God, Fajita Combo. You're listening to This Way Out,
the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
From his books on Hollywood's queer history to his works of fiction, William J. Mann is one prolific writer. This Way Out's Steve Pride talked with Mann about his latest novel, Where the Boys Are, and about old Hollywood and children's literature.
A few of my favorite novels and nonfiction books were all written by a gay man who lives in Provincetown, Massachusetts. William J. Mann, to be exact, a storyteller with movie star looks, his novels speak to the heart of the gay experience, and in a like manner, so do his nonfiction books that chronicle the history of gays and lesbians in Hollywood.
I'm William Mann, the author of Where the Boys Are, which is a sequel to my first novel, The Men from the Boys. For a long time, I resisted doing a sequel. The Men from the Boys did really well, and you know, I still get emails from people who have read it for the first time. And over the years, I would get letters saying, you know, would you ever go back? Would you tell us what happened to these characters? I really resisted it because there is an awful lot of autobiography in the book, though, of course, it comes through emotionally rather than literally, I think. The first book was a very personal story. It was in some ways a tribute to my own mentor in my own real life, Victor DeLugan, who was the basis for the character of Javits. Victor died subsequently to that book, and so I think there was some hesitancy on my part to revisit all that emotional trauma of experiencing his death. You know, one of the things that I'm pleased about with Where the Boys Are is I really feel like with The Men from the Boys, I've captured a slice of gay life today. And I think that's important. I'm writing about experiences that I think an awful lot of readers will recognize. We're still grieving this incredible loss that we had of so many years of losing so many friends and lovers to AIDS. And the grieving isn't over yet. And that's one of the points I make in this book, that we don't hear it talked about nearly as much anymore. We don't get the sense it's okay to still cry and to miss these people. It's let's move on. It's over. And of course, it's not over. And certainly the grieving isn't over. And that's, I haven't really seen that portrayed. This is still a very recent wound for many of us.
Besides his novels, The Men from the Boys, and its sequel, Where the Boys Are, Bill Mann is the author of a number of books that chronicle the stories of old Hollywood, including The Biograph Girl, a fictitious look at real-life silent film star Florence Lawrence. And he's become the leading scribe on the history of gay Hollywood with Wisecracker, The Life and Times of William Haynes, and Behind the Screen, How Gays and Lesbians Shaped Hollywood, 1910 through 1969.
I never thought, actually, that I would be known as this kind of gay Hollywood historian. I never expected that that would be something that I would be known for. And it was actually kind of fortuitous that that happened. I was writing for Architectural Digest and came across the story of William Haynes, who was this big, big movie star in the 1920s and went on to become this famous interior decorator to the stars. And I said, this is book material. There's something here. And so when I did that book and it came through, I had so much research and interviews and articles that I didn't use for that book. They just kind of sat in a big box. And I said, you know, this is too good to waste. And I presented it to my editor and he said, let's do another book. And so I did Behind the Screen, which was a story of gays and lesbians in Hollywood in the studio era. And so I'm now known as this kind of gay Hollywood historian, which I'm thrilled about, but it wasn't something that was planned. It just kind of happened.
In the golden age of Hollywood, for every Rock Hudson or Tony Perkins living in the closet, there were dozens of behind-the-scenes writers, designers, and directors leading more or less openly gay lives. It is this acknowledgement that elevates Mann's book, Behind the Screen, from sensational to landmark.
I didn't want to tell the story of just Cary Grant and Marlena Dietrich and all of them because, you know, that's been done. And while it's interesting, it really was such a small fragment of the gay experience in Hollywood in that era. You know, of all of the people who were living and working in the film industry in those years, only a very, very small percentage of them were movie stars. So I wanted to tell the whole story of gay men and lesbians working in the film industry. And so that meant taking into account everybody from writers and directors to editors and set designers and publicists, all of that. And to me, that gave a bigger picture of what the whole story was.
Although they are novels, both Where the Boys Are and Men from the Boys also traffic in history.
It's very gratifying to feel that in some way I am helping to document a culture, document a time. You know, the very last line of Men from the Boys, it's not giving anything away to relate it. It was, you know, when they look back at these times, when they write about these times, I will be able to say that I was there and I lived them. And I think that's important. I think that's something that I love doing. And I would rather write a book that sells as well as the Men from the Boys did. And I, you know, I continue to get letters from people from that. I continue to get royalties from that book. Then, you know, write a book with this attempt to, reach a bigger audience. I'm really happy with reaching this pretty substantial gay audience. That doesn't mean that I wouldn't love to write a book that reached readers beyond the gay market. I'd love to do that someday, if the story comes to me. I actually, if we talk about eclecticism, I also write children's books under a pseudonym, Jeffrey Huntington, and it's the Sorcerers of the Nightwing series. It's for young adult readers. It's probably maybe age 10 to 15, something like that. And those go out to a whole nother realm of readers. And, you know, I've realized that I have to tell the stories that are inside me rather than trying to reach a certain audience or something like that.
Author William J. Mann, reading from his book, Where the Boys Are.
I love gay men. They're my family, the only family I've ever really known. I love them despite their silliness, their bitchiness, their maddening reverence for the superficial. Sometimes I even love them for such things. Last summer, on Fire Island, I overheard a bunch of gay guys talking among themselves. Poor Kate Hepburn, one of them said. She's the next to go. It was completely endearing. Once, over breakfast at Bickford's after some late-night partying, Henry had asked me in utter seriousness who I loved better, Cher or Madonna, and I, with equal solemnity, had paused to consider the profound implications of the question. Our waitress may not have literally rolled her eyes as she tore off our check and placed it on our table, but I felt her bemusement nonetheless. Henry and I looked at each other and cracked up. I forgive gay culture its indulgences because they're sincere. I'm so tired of all this caterwauling and bitchery from the self-appointed critics of gay culture who throw out words like tedious and childish and trifling. Sometimes gay people can be far more savaging of our own lives than any fault finder of the religious right.
This has been a visit with novelist and historian William J. Mann. For more information, drop by his website at williamjmann.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, John Beaupre, Fensbury, Graham Underhill, Rex Wagner, Janet Mason, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Deborah D'Alessandro and J.D. Doyle. Holly Neer performed Imagine My Surprise, Juliet sang I Need a Man, Michael Callan crooned Where the Boys Are, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can also listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air and get some queer audio history and timeless music in the bargain, please visit our website at thiswayout.org. Email us at tworadio@aol.com or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. And thanks to Alternabid and the Stonewall Society, you can still bid on some terrific items in an online auction to benefit This Way Out. Look for the This Way Out auction area at alternabid.com. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KUCR Riverside, California, CITR Vancouver, British Columbia, WCBN Ann Arbor, Michigan, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we hope you'll stay tuned.